Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the World Affairs Council and all of our community partners, I'm Gordon Hine, Vice President of Programs at the Asia Foundation, and will serve as your moderator this evening. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guests. Min Zin is a leading journalist on Burma, a political scientist, and a frequent contributor to foreignpolicy.com's transition blog. To his left, Nguyen Than is the chair and co-founder of the Burmese American Democratic Alliance, founded in 2001 to advocate for democracy and freedom for the Burmese people. Stan Zee is the chairman of the board of Community Partners International, which is the largest independently supported U.S. nonprofit dedicated to the health of the people of Burma. In the interest of time, you'll see we've provided full bios for everyone on the back of the program flyer. Let me say at the outset how delighted I am to be here this evening from the Asia Foundation. As many of you know, the Asia Foundation is a nonprofit international development organization working on the ground in Asia since 1954. We have our headquarters here in San Francisco, but we work through a network of 17 country offices throughout the region. We focus primarily on issues of governance and legal reform, women's empowerment, economic policy, the environment, and regional cooperation. We maintained a resident country office and program in Burma from 1958 until 1962, when the military coup took place, and we, along with the other Western organizations operating there had to leave. 4 years ago, we restarted our book donation program to Burmese organizations throughout the country, and we're now in the process of exploring new program opportunities and reestablishing our formal presence in the country. I've been in Burma three times myself this year and just returned over the weekend from a trip to Yangon and Naypyidaw. Of course, the topic of change and reform in Burma could not be more timely. There is widespread global interest in the events that have taken place in Burma in the year and a half since President Thein Sein came to power, including, of course, the landslide election victory by the National League of Democracy in the April 1st by-elections that swept Aung San Suu Kyi and 41 of her NLD colleagues into parliament. Everyone inside and outside the country is trying to understand the exact nature and depth and likely impact of the reform process that's underway. How genuine and potentially far-reaching are the reforms? What is driving and motivating the reform process? And what will it ultimately mean for the people of Burma and for the long-term prospects for peace, democracy, and development for the country? We're very fortunate tonight to have three experts with us who I'm sure can shed much light on these and other questions. I'm going to invite each of our guests to speak, to give their remarks. They'll speak for about 15 minutes each, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions from all of you. Our first speaker will be Min Zin, who will talk about the current reforms taking place and what they might mean for the future of the country. Min Zin? Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and also thank you for coming to this talk. I mean, Burma used to be known as a land of fear. Sorry, land of golden land. Because our country, you can see the Buddhist temple, pagoda, shining all over the country. And also, we used to be known as the rice bowl of the world because Burma was the largest rice exporters in the world in early 20th centuries. But since 1962, the whole picture changed. Burma became a land of fear. The name speaks for itself. So, but recently, much surprise to observers, the picture began to change. And we see a lot of changes in terms of the government, a new government took office in 2011, and the government released hundreds of political prisoners, and the government allowed the opposition leader, who was also released from under house arrest, Aung San Suu Kyi. Government allowed Aung San Suu Kyi and her party to re-enter the mainstream politics. As Dr. Hain said, you know, the opposition political party won a landslide in the by-election, even though it was only less than 10% of the parliamentary seats. But it was very a symbolic and very powerful message to the whole war and to the opposition movement inside and abroad. So also there have been a lot of positive responses from the international community. And then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Burma, and then U.S. Resumed, you know, the ambassador Levy relationship with Obama, and also UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon visited Obama. So all these things are like fascinating, at the same time puzzling, very puzzling. What has happened in Burma in, you know, like less than a year? So the country like a year ago was condemned as a one of the worst tyranny in the world, and now being praised as a model for the political transition for other dictatorial countries. So I just want to share my thought. So in order to address these puzzle, so I will address three puzzle. The first question is, why is reform taking place now? The second question is, how do we make sense of the change that is going on in Burma? The third question is, what is the prospect? What is likely to happen in near future or distant future? Let's start with the first question. There are three complementary explanations to explain why reform is taking place now. The first one is Burmese military. They wanted to reduce their over-reliance on China. That's what the first argument. The second one is Burmese military wanted to avoid another popular uprising. That's what happened in 1988. What happened in 2007, especially in the context of Arab Spring. They really want to avoid another massive uprising, because at the end, whenever they face uprising, they had to kill, no matter they were students or Buddhist monks. So they really wanted to avoid that kind of another uprising. The third explanation was more to do with the economy. I mean, the country, even though exposed to the like foreign trade and, you know, investment mainly in the resource area, but the country is at the bottom of every index you can pull, you know, from the internet. We are at the bottom. So the economic imperative is, that's a thought reason that drive these generals in power to shift course. Let me briefly go through one after another. The first one. The first one is over-reliance on China. I think since 1988, one military took power by killing democracy activists, democracy protesters. We have like 8888, like 48 democracy movement, and the military seized power by killing thousands of people. Then international community, especially Western government, sanctioned Burmese military and tried to isolate them. So since then, Burmese military were forced to engage, forced to relate with the China. Even though Burmese military traditionally saw Chinese as like arch enemy, because Chinese Communist Party was the one who supported Burmese Communist Party, that was Burmese military fought against, you know, to death. So even though from that background, Burmese military, because of international isolation, been forced to closer to China. Since then, the relation between two countries became so much profound, especially in political, economic, and security cooperation. But reliance, at the same time, Burmese military, they found like they believe Chinese are taking advantage of their isolation. For example, like they rely on Chinese military weapons and like arms and services and equipment and, you know, training, but they realize these are very poor quality. There was an increase in unhappiness on part of the Burmese military since mid-1990s. They tried to diversify their source of supply. They tried to approach Pakistan, you know, Russia, North Korea. I mean, in 2002, they bought MiG-29, you know, jet fighter from, like, I think total 10 of MiG-29 jet fighter from Russia, because they were so frustrated with the Chinese jet fighters and, like, all these weapons. So, but on the other hand, the Burma became key, you know, part of the Chinese strategy. So Chinese really want to get the Burmese natural resources. For example, China is now building two pipelines across Burma from western Burma to the southwest of China, like Yunnan province. The one pipeline to ship Burmese natural gas, the other pipeline to ship, to transport Middle East crude oil, so the Chinese can avoid Strait of Malacca, so that they could avoid, you know, security risks posed by the U.S. and other allies. So Chinese have a strategic reason to use Burma as that, you know, natural resource. Not only that, gas and oil, but also recently, like late last year, China was building 8 dams, huge hydro dams in Upper Burma. I mean, the biggest dams, the size of the dam is, the reservoir is bigger than Singapore, the size of Singapore. So huge. It became very controversial. So Chinese has a huge interest in natural resources. At the same time, Chinese really want to, according to the many experts, China want to dominate like both ocean, Pacific as well as Indian Ocean. So Burma is like exit for the Indian Ocean. So Chinese want to use Burma as a sea exit to access Indian Ocean. So, I mean, there are security, you know, political and economic interests for China. So that's the key issue for the dilemma for the Burmese military, how they're going to reduce that, you know, influence, how they're going to steer themselves away from the China orbit. So that's the one thing. The second thing, I would say, like, that's why, like, for many military officers, when you talk to them, they say, like, they really want to re-engage with the West, especially with the United States. Many Burmese top military officers ask American officers, can we join Cobra Go? Cobra Go is like the U.S.-led military exercise in Asia. It's the biggest one. So whenever U.S. senior officers visit Burma, all these so-called civilian ministers refuse, oh, we don't have any human rights violation here. But whenever the U.S. official talk to the Burmese military, like commander-in-chief or like defense minister, yes, we have problem. We want to resolve it. We need your help. So they really want to confront that, and they want to bait, you know, U.S. assistance. So that's how, like, it's a big incentive for the military officers to reduce their reliance on China. Otherwise, they know they'll end up as a North Korea. That's what happened, like, in previous Hunter. So this is the first reason. The second reason, I want to make it brief, but the second reason is more like uprising. I mean, many of you are aware the 2007 Buddhist monk that took to the streets and, like, staged protests, especially in that contest of the Arab Spring. That's likelihood is very high, mainly because of military in their constitution and in 2010 election, they excluded opposition. So on the one hand, you excluded opposition. And on the other hand, your economy is really bad. So there's a chance for the opposition to rally public, to stage against the government. So military need to co-opt the opposition and please considerable segment of the population so that they can avoid the another possibility of uprising. So this is the second reason. The third reason is economy. And it's very obvious, so I don't want to go into detail because my time is quite limited. So, but these three, like, big the factors. But for me, I talk about it, I wrote about it, but I'm not that, like, fully satisfied, you know, because these factors have been there for a long time. These factors did not pose any immediate or urgent threat to the regime's survival. Then how come they made change? And why now? That's what, like, puzzled me all the time. So that I found, like, two reasons, at least. One is that it's very important to look at the old dictator, Tan Shui. He was the leader of the Burmese military until the new government took power in 2011. this old dictator decided to retire. It was interesting. And dictatorship, I mean, they retire when they die, right? Otherwise, you will be ended up in the prison. But this guy managed to arrange the transition or like succession arrangement. And he tried to put all these potential, you know, successors in a different institution. Pit one against another. And he made sure no one come out as a like stronger, you know, successor and like pose a threat to him. So that's how he could have his retirement in a peaceful way. So the first thing is, if these guys refuse to retire, objectively speaking, I don't think there is no problem. He could have survived until he died, because he could use all ruthless, you know, means. There is no international community could intervene effectively. I mean, we had all precedent. So I think that's a very important factor. That guy decided to retire. The second thing is institution. I think as a political scientist, many people would say institution matters. I think when this guy, the Tanshui, when he designed 2008 Constitution was really bad. Because, I mean, you had military being granted 25% of seat without contesting election. You have the military have their own judiciary, you know, and all other privileges. And you have the military could take power legally if the military think the country is in danger. So it's a very, you know, and the worst thing is it's very difficult to amend. They make it very unamendable. So, but in that constitution, that's a one clause. That clause allow, if you became president or cabinet minister of the country, you have to retire temporarily. You have to resign temporarily from the parliament. You have to retire temporarily from your own mother party. So the president, Thanesay, is no longer officially leader of his party. He's no longer member of parliament. That's why we have by election. So that make the whole cabinet and presidents kind of floating head. They don't have anyone they could be accountable to. So they could pursue whatever policy they want to without being accountable to their own party. So the military-backed political party that won landslide in 2010, that party, in a way, was a election-winning party, but never ruling party. It's a weird arrangement. The arrangement was done by the former dictator in order to weaken his successor. But that allowed the successor to pursue reform agenda without being constrained by the body, parliament, and other institutions. So these guys started, the president started relying on the technocrat. He pursued so many policies that contradict the policy of the party. And on the other hand, it's a lot easier because he decided not to rerun in the 2015 election. So he's like one-time shooter. So then that's make him, he can do whatever he wants to do without thinking too much of the party and, you know, parliament. So to me, these two factors are very interesting, very important. We need to explore more. And I will go like second question after talking about the why reform is taken now. I will go second question briefly. Second puzzle I posed was how do we make sense of the change? I think since 1962, Burma has faced two power distribution problems, I would say. One is people do not have the right to choose their own government. Until now, they are 25% of the military, you know, holding in the parliament. So people do not have right to choose their own government. The second one is the ethnic minority group. They do not have equal right, you know, and power vis-a-vis Burman-dominated center. So like center periphery problem. So in other words, it's about democracy problem. The other one is ethnic autonomy or federalism problem. So these problems are the most fundamental problem in Burma. But these two problems have not been resolved, even under current presidency, mainly because of the constitution constraint. So I would say these are the very important measure we need to use when we examine the change. And another important factor, I would say very briefly, because of the almost a half a century of military rule, the whole, I would say, playing field are very uneven, skewed. You know, in Burma, you have military, their family members, their cronies. They are the ones who are able to access to resource, knowledge, institution, skill. So the peoples are still in the dark. Even though there's a lot of rhetoric, but that these rhetoric or these changes so far hasn't trickled down to the people. People still suffer from poverty, you know, and then forced relocation, land confiscation. So I think that the skewed playing field is the one factor we should consider when we look at the how we make sense of change. So in terms of prospect, the last question, the last puzzle I pose, I would say we have to see a 2015 election. What would happen in post-2015 election? Because will military accept the Aung San Suu Kyi landslide victory? Will military accept, all these political party, current administration, they are all important, but the most important institution in Burma is military. Military is not there as a government, but military is there as an institution. They are still powerful. So it all depends on military. So we need to look at how military would react for the post-2015 election scenario. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Minzin. You covered a lot of ground. Our next speaker is Nun Thanh, who will talk about the role of activists inside and outside of Burma, given the current and fast-changing realities taking place in the country.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming here, and thank you for Welfare Council for having us, and especially focusing this program on Burma. So I'm very honored to be here. I was from the Burmese American Democratic Alliance, founded in 2001 by all the volunteers. I was one of the students. I was schooling in Burma in 1988. So after a few years, I graduated and I decided I couldn't stand anymore here. I couldn't see those faces on the televisions or in the newspapers. All the lies, you know, that the military is making and oppressing our population, I decided I'm going to leave this country. So in April of 1992, I went back to my village, which I rarely go there, went there, and I saw even the massive forced labor. My village is nowhere near these where the ethnics are living or border areas, which is only 70 miles from Rangoon. So there, I saw from the loudspeakers, you have to fulfill your quota of digging. Otherwise, you will be severely punished. All the roads are clear, trees are cut down for the military because they want to have their army, you know, quickly deploy. So I left Burma in 1992 in that situation, and then I decided, you know, I will never go back until Burma got democracy. So I spent 4 years in Singapore. Even though so close to Burma, just a few hours' flight, I never go back. And I came here in 1998. Since then, 1996, since then I've been involved with the activism for more than 14 years. So for the first time in my history, you know, I was born in 1996. That is a year that the military took over power. So there hasn't been a, you know, day that we didn't think about freedom and democracy in our country, and the suffering of our people, and you know how we can do to help, especially after 1988. But for the first time in my life, I see some promising things. Even some of my dreams are coming true. The first dream, our leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, is visiting San Francisco. So this is going to be the first stream. So we always talk about, you know, one day when Burma got democracy, why not we have Aung San Suu Kyi here? Why not we all have her here? It's going to happen. She's going to be here on September 29, morning of the September 29. The second thing is I have decided to go back to Burma end of this year, because one of my institution, Rangoon Institute of Technology, is having a worldwide reunion at the school, which has been closed down. The school was covered by dust and all the grasses. Now it has been cut down. The school is reopened, so we are trying to help rebuild that as well. So I'm planning to attend that reunion in December, as well as you know, meeting with some of my colleagues and activists. So, but it depends on the regime if they gave me the visa. Just today there was a news. There's 6,000 people who are blacklisted, meaning that these people are not allowed to come back. But the regime, the government, have removed 2,000 out of 6,000. I hope I'm in that 2,000 list. So anyway, you know, especially I'm an activist. I try to help, so I follow the news. Especially today, I try to go and see, you know, here and there, and especially read a lot of news. You know, it tells me what I'm seeing and happening in Burma. The reform is actually taking shape. That's what I will say. Everybody involved in this what's going on in Burma, all the stakeholder, the regime, the army, Aung San Suu Kyi, all the activists, oppositions. I mean, all of us, even the international community, we are in unfamiliar territory. We don't know what will end up being. But what I can tell you is everybody is trying, and some of the reforms are taking shape. That I can tell you, and I'm going to give you why. Aung San Suu Kyi recently released from the house arrest, right? In and out. Since 1988, you know, more than 20 years. The only good news we got is, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi was let go of the house arrest. She couldn't do anything. Now she is towing the world, even Europe, and you know. And in some way, selling the regime, you know, propaganda to let go of the sanctions, to ease the sanctions, right? Because she herself become part of the government, because the government, and especially the President Thein Sein, was able to relate to her, able to convince her that he has a genuine reform agenda. So Aung San Suu Kyi herself was a part of the government. She is doing, especially she is coming here as well to accept the Congressional Gold Medal on the September 19. So this is one of the reasons why I'm telling this. I also read the article, interview with the president with the VAO, what's going on in Arakan State. I read through from the start to the end. And, you know, it tells me, as a Burmese activist, Burmese citizen, We have a couple of, you know, four, five, six presidents. We have never had the interview in the level of his clarity and sincerity and honesty. What he is telling, what's going on in Arakan States, and the way he is addressing for the questions by the BOA reporters, it is very clear he is so sincere. He's not defending anything. He has any propaganda or any agenda. He admits some of the things that they would have found. I mean, some of the media would have done differently, or how the international media is, you know, also making the mistakes in, you know, in addressing the situation there. Since also, I look at the activists there. Many of them were recently released. I see, you know, they are actually part of the society, part of the change, part of the game. Many of them are trying to find a footing and try to see where they fit. And just today, some of the activists came back from the Kachin State. They went to the Kachin State. There's a battle between government and the Kachin army. So then there's so many refugees, and they came there and they came back and reports why the peace deal is still not going through. What are the challenges between this Kachin ethnic armies and the governments? And those activists are actually the activists that we used to support. We used to be proud of. We are inspired. So they are there. They went there and they make a press announcement or press conference, and they said these are what I see. People are suffering. You know, why the government and the kitchen? There's a, what are the challenges in between? Why the ceasefire is not, the peace deal is not being going forward? And also, and like as Komenzian said, you know, Burma, in Burma, the land grabbing is so severe. Even as much as in China. At one point, I read in the New York Times what it says, you know, in China, the movie, I hope I pronounce correctly, Avatar, the movie, the digital movie, right? Avatar is so widely popular in China. Why? Land grabbing in China is so severe. That's what is written in New York Times. So in Burma, the same thing is happening. Right before this, you know, after 2011, elections, before this civilian-looking regime was handed over by power, by the military dictatorship, they actually divided this country and they let go of many institutions, many lands. All those armies and elites have divided this country and they have built business and companies all over the countries. Now, even today, there's a severe flood in Rangoon area because the one of the tunnels which take away the flood water out of this Rangoon was blocked to protect the lands and the buildings owned by the companies. That's 1,000 acres. Just to protect, the tunnel was totally blocked so that the whole area was flooded. The whole area was flooded, you know, severe flood as we speak. So because this company has the authority to block this tunnel, which will take the rainwater out of the Rangoon area. So that's what's going on. So people are protesting. And just today, I saw another thing. Farmers are also protesting, take back our land. What happened? More than 1,000 in Upper Burma Monyoa area, one of the copper mining company, which work with the Burmese company, actually grabbed more than 1,000 acres from the farmers. So now farmers are protesting. So laborers are also protesting. We just have an activist monk came from Burma. He was actually recently forced out of his monastery because he was so outspoken. Also, he went to the Upper Burma. He speak to the Aung San Suu Kyi headquarters at the monthly headquarters to his to Aung San Suu Kyi party members. For that, he was forced out of his own monastery where he stayed there for 37 years since he was 10 years old. He has to live on the grass for 3 days. Then he built a bamboo hut, small bamboo hut. Then there's one of the students saw his story on the television. So he convinced his parents, so, "Mom and Dad, can you build this monk a small building for him to live?" So he has a now small building almost done. So we invited him to come here. He's touring. So what he said is, you know, he's also outspoken. Laborers are also striking. Whenever the laborers strike, the factory owners will insist. You know, these people will give in after a few months, few weeks, because they have nothing to eat. Monks like this activist monk and also the student activist who was released from the prison, they actually went there, they go and feed them. You know, they gave them the rice bags and they gave them the money. So that empower, so eventually what happened is whenever there's a labor strike, whenever these factory owners here, these monks and 88 generation activists are coming, they actually, you know, try to settle the things much quicker. So those are the things that, you know, I'm seeing that reform is in Burma is taking place. And another thing, you know, it also strikes me what's happening in Burma Parliament. You know, Burma Parliament has a 25% was actually occupied by the military-appointed representatives. If you look at the pictures, you will see literally soldiers are sitting in the parliament alongside Aung San Suu Kyi and all those civilian elected persons. So there's a 25%, and there's a Aung San Suu Kyi party, which has about 44, 45 seats, and all the oppositions. In all the oppositions and Aung San Suu Kyi party combines is about, you know, 17%, if I didn't get wrong. So military 25%, the rest of the is about 50% is the military-supported USDP. Government-supported former general turned civilian-looking people. The party has still have 50%. Military has about 25%. Aung San Suu Kyi has 17%. All the rest of the opposition is rest. So this is the distribution in the Congress right now. So what happened is recently there's a constitutional tribunal, which is about 10 people appointed by the president. So the tribunal make this one judgment. One call. What they said is, all the committee formed by this parliament, from the elected representatives, are not at the federal level committee. So this is what the tribunal, constitutional tribunal, they have to interpret all the what's happening at the parliament is in accordance with the constitution. Their interpretation is that any committee formed by this parliament are not the federal level parliament. So that anger many of the elected parliaments there. Actually, these are military-backed regime, military-backed parliaments. Aung San Suu Kyi member, military-backed parliaments, party members, Aung San Suu Kyi party members, in some of the militaries, in all the opposition actually today voted to censure this constitutional tribunal, which is appointed by the president. So president says, you can't fire them. Actually, they wanted to fire them. You can fire them. If you want to fire them, you have to change. President Thein Sein in the parliament is right now, as we speak, they are in the middle of crisis. That's why Aung San Suu Kyi was meeting with Thein Sein a couple of times in the last few weeks. So, you know, this is unbelievable because, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi in this USDP, which is a military, very much military regime, which steal the election in 2010 election from the Aung San Suu Kyi, right? I thought they will be at odds at the parliament. Aung San Suu Kyi and all those opposition will not be able to do anything. But now what we are seeing is totally different. President Thein Sein, which is from the same party, is on the same party, used to be the same party, is on the other side, offending, defensive. In some of the soldiers, some of the military-backed regime, Aung San Suu Kyi party and all the oppositions are on one side, try to fire them. So because of this, I think that the reform is taking shape. But I have some concern. So some of the concern is, as Kominzen said, I have a couple of concerns. Some of the investment, mega investment going on in Burma are very scary. It is not only going to take away our natural resources, it's also going to spoil our way of living, and also tourism. China is building high-speed railroads to Burma. Also, there's a Burma road that connect India and China, which is almost, you know, India and China is ready. Only Burma, but it's remained to be built. One that is done, the floodgate is going to open in the northern Burma for much of the Chinese tourists to come in. So those are the things that, you know, we are so worried about. So we have to keep our eye on this irresponsible investment. So United States has removed the sanctions, right? So responsible investment, also responsible tourism. This is the most important things that, you know, we have to keep our eyes as an activist here. So, you know, we as a activist here, that's what we are doing. Try to keep our eyes on the human rights situations. Some of the human rights violations are still happening in much of the country, especially in the border area. So we are keeping our eyes on that. At the same time, all of us are in the unfamiliar territory, new territory. So we are also trying to transition ourselves, not just a human rights political activist, also how we can take part in this reform, in this rebuildings. So, for example, we are trying to work with whatever we can, plans to help send volunteers, more and more volunteers go to Burma and teach and help whatever they can over there, English, IT, human rights, whatever. So all in all, you know, this is my message today is I am very much convinced what's going on in Burma is a real reform. And other things, and also last things, the president just today let go many 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 ministers, which are known as a opposition to the reformist. Many hardlines are let go. Today, he has appointed about 8 new ministers. So because of all those things, I am convinced that the reforms are going on. I think we will be able to see much brighter future in Burma. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Neon Than. It's very interesting to get the perspective of a real activist and democracy advocate, and to hear a encouraging overall view of the reform process, but also some very important concerns about the direction of the country going forward that you want to keep monitoring closely. Lastly, we're going to hear from Stan Z, who will speak about how the work of aid groups and NGOs inside Burma will be affected by the reforms and the changes in policy that are taking place in the country, and what it will mean for new groups seeking to work inside Burma. So, Stan?
Thank you. Thanks for having me here tonight. And obviously, this is a very exciting time to work in the humanitarian space in Burma. And I'm encouraged to see all of you here tonight, since many of you have been and probably will continue to be instrumental in facilitating additional reforms in the country. My fellow panelists have covered quite a bit of ground, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief. But for some of you who probably don't follow Burma that closely, I thought it might be helpful to give you a little bit of at least context as to how NGO historically have worked or not worked in the country, just so that you can appreciate the significance of the reforms that have taken place since March of 2011, when the nominal civilian government has taken power. In general, international organizations, especially the ones based in the U.S., have found it very, very difficult to work in Burma in the past. Simply put, for both legal and practical reasons, many U.S. Organizations have historically shunned a presence in the country. Legally, there were certainly economic sanctions in place here in the United States until very recently. And in Burma, it was incredibly difficult to be registered as an aid organization. Excuse me, as an aid organization, so that in essence, our in-country staff would be working illegally in the country. Practically, there were also incredible barriers to working inside the country. Most organizations found it very difficult to access vast parts of the country because of conflicts, ongoing conflicts, and oftentimes those were the areas where the needs were the greatest. Even simple things like getting visas for your expat staff was very, very difficult. And there were also all kinds of significant practical challenges, such as just getting money into the country. The Burmese banking system was not connected with the international financial system, so moving money into the country was a significant challenge for lots of organizations. On top of this, the Burmese government historically has been quite xenophobic. As many of you may remember, in 2008, there was a significant cyclone, a huge devastating cyclone that hit the country. And although precise numbers are not available, some estimates put maybe 150 to 200,000 people may have died in that cyclone. And in the aftermath of that devastation, the Burmese government basically refused assistance from virtually all international organizations. And when I was in the country, immediately after that cyclone, I remember just sitting in Yangon, in Rangoon, surrounded by aid organization representatives who had no access to, the affected areas. And recently, I had an opportunity to listen to the Minister of Health from Burma, who was touring the United States, and he made an address to the Burmese American physicians in Los Angeles, and he made some remarks that, again, I think highlighted the wariness that the government still views outside aid organizations. He highlighted in his speech that he thought that lots of international organizations were using the, basically the plight of the Burmese people to raise, you know, vast amounts of money. But that money was not being channeled for the use of the Burmese people, but really to go to build infrastructure for, you know, these aid organizations and for, you know, for bureaucratic purposes. And so I think it's very telling that it has not been a very welcoming environment for organizations in the past. And that's why it's been very, very significant to see some of these changes that have taken place in the last year and a half. With respect to the specific changes that are most, I guess, directly applicable to INGOs and other organizations seeking to work in the country, the process of registering in the country has been significantly expedited. Recently, I was in Naypyidaw, the new capital, and we had discussions about registering our organization, Community Partners International, to work in the country. And I was struck by how positive the discussion was and how welcoming the government officials were in terms of encouraging us to register in the country. They also assured us that the registration process could take place in a much more expedited process, occurring, you know, perhaps within months as opposed to the years it used to take. And so that's an important development, since for many organizations that seek to tap into institutional funding, you really need to be registered in the country or else institutional donors are unwilling to fund. I also want to highlight the fact that there has been increased security and openness for many of the people working in this area as a result of these reforms. As an example, our own program director, who's a young Burmese physician, recently spent 6 weeks at Johns Hopkins University in an intensive health seminar, and he was joined by various officials from the Ministry of Health. And as a result of that experience, when he returned to the country, he's been invited to conferences, and he's been able to collaborate with them, and they've been very helpful in helping him further some of our programs. And these are the same people that maybe 2 years ago, you know, he would have to hide from and probably, you know, stay away from. So these are very, very significant, I think, developments as a result of these reforms. You know, in terms of, you know, there was a reference to the blacklist. I think there's, it's interesting for me to see that there are folks who historically have been, you know, sort of state enemies, like take someone like George Soros, who has, you know, visited the country earlier this year and has now pledged to set up a philanthropic arm in the country. And so these are, again, very significant signs of the kind of changes that are taking place in this space. I just want to take also a minute just to touch on the issue, or another byproduct of these changes is that there's been a significant convergence of the various groups that historically have worked on the border and the groups that have been operating in a central region. As many of you may know, many of the border groups were historically comprised or drawn from the ethnic groups, and many of them were from the exile community. And there was a split because many of the other groups that were working inside the country tend to be drawn from the Burmese majority and tend sometimes to be seen as being a little bit cozy with the Burmese government. In our own organization, that same split, you know, was also reflected in the sense of we actually operated in the central area as under a name called Friends for Health, and we operated in a border region as the Global Health Access Program. And, you know, just 2 years ago, those two branches were kept completely separate, and there was very, very little interaction between those two branches. Since the reforms have taken place, there's been more of a convergence of those two branches. We've been able to collaborate, share information, and standardize the systems between the two branches. And our local partners in the border regions are actually now starting to open up to the possibility of working with the actual the Burmese government. And so that's also been very, very encouraging. In terms of, you know, there's still incredible challenges for new groups that are looking to work in a country. There are lots of organizations actually almost tripping over each other to get into the country. So I think it's imperative that donors find some sort of mechanism to coordinate and prioritize a development plan for the good of the country. I would also note that transparency and accountability for both the recipient population and also the donor side is paramount for a country that historically has not been very transparent. And I would also stress that one of the lessons that we learned from Cyclone Nargis was that small is beautiful in the sense of a lot of the most effective organizations on the ground are a small community-based organization. Unfortunately, many of the largest institutional funders have to put large amounts of money to work quickly, and they have a great deal of difficulty working with smaller organizations. And so I think that's going to be a challenge for the donor community is to try to build more effective and long-term relationships with those, you know, CBOs. I think, you know, there's still significant challenges, and even with the continuing frustrations of aid not reaching the people and some of the communities in Burma who need it most, it's an incredibly exciting time to be doing humanitarian work there. And reform has created unprecedented opportunities to rebuild democratic civil society and help the people of Burma. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stan. Stan's organization, Community Partners International, which is located here in the Bay Area, is doing exceptional work inside the country with a range of local partner organizations. There are so many questions. We have not only a large audience, but a spirited one and clearly a well-informed one. There is no way we're going to be able to get to all the questions. I'm going to try to group them a bit and to give our panelists a chance to respond to some collections of questions. There are a number having to do with the continuing democratic reforms and democratization process. There are a number of questions, not surprisingly, about ethnic minorities and ethnic conflict in the border areas. There are some questions about economic development strategy and foreign investment. There are a number of questions about foreign policy issues, role of the United States, of China and India, and so on, just to give them a little heads up of what's coming. Let's continue on the democratization thread for a little bit, and then we definitely want to spend some time talking about the ethnic minority issues, which are, of course, so important and so challenging in Burma. There are some questions about the state of the press and the media. So people would like to get your sense of the level of freedom of the press and government censorship and scrutiny. Also the role of the Internet in terms of a role in political participation, political activism, and question about the fate of remaining political prisoners. And there still are some. And then an intriguing question, if the NLD wins in 2015, how well prepared are they to govern? Let me ask the panelists to perhaps respond on some of these questions about the challenges associated with the political reform process, the free press, role of the Internet, looking ahead, the 2015 election. And there's also an intriguing question about the role of the universities, which, of course, were closed for so many years. So I don't know who would like to let's start with you, Min Sen, if you want to take on some of that set of issues.
With regard to the role of press, the encouraging news was that recently the Burmese government abolished the censorship, basically pre-censorship. Before then, if you want to publish anything, you have to submit, you know, manuscript to the government, and the government has to prove. So they abolished that procedure. So it was a big improvement, I would say. But it doesn't mean they're not going to monitor. This is still like press censor board. They can still monitor you. They can call you. you know, what are you doing with this news? For example, recently in news channels reported about the health condition of former general, like the previous one of the second top leader of the previous hunter. He was sick, according to the report, and then that report was basically sanctioned by the authority. So authority could still give you trouble. And I would say, like, with, I mean, lately, what troubled me a lot with regard to media, and in general, internet, social media, and the local publication, was I found it like a lot of capacity problem. There is no, I mean, it's understandable because of under a lot of authority, I mean, long years of authoritarianism, but local medias are, it also depends on the ownership, you know, who own it. I mean, many of these guys used to be very close to the regime. So they have that nationalistic, you know, kind of bent. So once something happened in Oregon State, so they all, like, instead of, like, critically reporting, instead of, like, doing investigative reporting, that's what we need in Burma. We don't need too much opinion. We need facts, right? Who is in corruption? Who is, like, violating human rights? Who released the pictures of, like, rape victim in that, you know, situation? So we need facts. We need media to do investigation and report rather than this is what we hear from the local people. We can verify, but please read. So that's not what we want. So that what we are seeing right now in the social media and also a lot of like Burmese military officers, they use different names on the Facebook and other social medias and to instigate racial hatred. So then that's fuel all these animosity. So to me, I'm very much troubling that one thing is very encouraging. And on the other hand, because of that, you know, capacity, like professionalism, I would say. Lack of this can lead to huge instability. You know, we all know modernity is okay, but modernization is a problem. We all know democracy is okay, but democratization process is troubling. So it is that process that make all these repress, you know, tension coming up, like the kind of genies, you know, like a box of the genies, right? So, like, you just... You have to be very careful. Otherwise, you know, it will lead to a huge instability. And then as politics, who gets what and how? You know, there's always someone who take benefit out of this, who take advantage out of this. Definitely military. Now, because of all these racial riots, military came out as a, like, national savior. You know, it says we have to... I mean, to me, I think when we talk about the media, I think I want to highlight this. We really need professionalism. It doesn't mean there's a lot really good reporting there. Many reporters like sacrifice a lot in prison and they got released. But at the same time, I don't want to shy away from saying like we have troubling problem. I mean we have troubling issue in our media too.
Thank you, Nathan. Would you want to comment on the state of the press and the media, including the internet, and also the question about remaining political prisoners?
Yeah, I agree with Ko Minzen. Actually, when I read the president interview about what's going on in Oregon State and the Burmese media respond, so he admitted initially, you know, emotionally they have been reported on the side of more, you know, take over by the nationalism and all that. But now, according to his response, people understand this is also about humans. This is also about humanitarian situations. So the media has been slowly, you know, being try to tone down what they might have done, but I have not seen any of those. I'm just interpreting from what Kuminzen said and what the president Thein said. So now they are kind of try to also address not the point of view of the nationalism as well as the humanitarian aspect of what's going on over there. So that's what media and also another issue with reform. I think the. Unless we can rein down in the corruptions and rules of law, I mean, this reform is nowhere near where we want to be. So recently, at the parliament, actually, Don San Suu Kyi was appointed or chosen as the chair of the Rule of Law and Stability Committee. This is where the just censure of the Constitutional Tribunal is happening, because she was recently appointed from that committee, and then the tribunal says these committees are not at the federal level. Try to press down. So anyway, I think this society, you have to understand this society. This society has been oppressed, deprived, and we have no opportunity, to learn. Even myself, right? I left Burma in 1992. My age is about 32 years old. I don't understand or heard this thing called activist. I'm activist, 14, 15 years have been here. But I have never heard of this word called activist. Or I never really understand what this means. So this is a society, just let it go, just opening up. So you are going to see so many things that, so many shortcomings. But I overall, I think that the people in the some of the reformers in the regime, and also leader like Aung San Suu Kyi, they all together overcome with all these challenges, what's going on at the border, in the border area, as well as in Arakan state. We just need to give time in some conference so that they will adjust, they address to the challenges. And I'm always more optimistic, because as far as I've been in 14 years of my activism, challenges are what make you stronger and better. So what's going on in Arakan states and all the conflict, I hope this will not eclipse or this will not take away our great struggle for 5 decades, right? But it will make, all those challenges will make our people much stronger. They will, or everybody will come a winner from these struggles. So that's my comment about this media.
Okay. Stan, do you want to?
I would only add on the sort of the situation in the Arakan state. I think as I watch from the and read about it from here and talk to various people, I am sort of dismayed by the fact that people are talking about it in terms of the Muslims and the Buddhists and sort of this whole nationalistic nationalism coming through. At the end of the day, it's a humanitarian issue, and there are people who need help. And I think both the Burmese government and also international community has responsibilities with respect to those people. So,
okay. Yeah, just following up on that, there as I said, there are a number of questions about the ethnic conflicts that have been going on inside the country. In some cases, for decades in the border areas, and particularly the recent events with the Rohingya Muslim community. The question is, will the current government or an NLD government led by Aung San Suu Kyi be in a better position to do a better job on national reconciliation and improving relations between the majority Burman population and the ethnic minorities in terms of achieving long-term reconciliation and stability in the country?
I would say the ethnic issue is the most important issue, in Burma, because it's involved not only an autonomy issue, it's involved drug trafficking, it's involved, other illicit issues, and also it's involved resource. Most of the resources in Burma are in ethnic minority area, but these people do not benefit from these resources. For many years, Burman center, Burman dominated government, exploited resources. I mean, Arakan state, for example. Even though Arakan people, they kill Muslim, Rohingya, they kill each other. They both are underdog, They both are loser, right? They are the underdog. They kill each other. Because Arakan state, all resources like natural gases and all oil are exploited by Chinese and Burmese military. So my point is, ethnic issue is very important, probably the most important issue in Burma. Unless we resolve this issue, we can get sustainable, democracy as well as the economic growth. We will see a lot of unjust, unfair treatment toward each other. And I will tell you very briefly, I think I would see this process going on in Burma as more as a institution building or more as a state building rather than democratization. If we see them from the democratization perspective, you have too much expectation. I think the problem in Burma is the central state hasn't have, I mean, geographically and functionally, not being reached out to the whole territory, what we call Burma. I mean, a lot of borderlands are being controlled by the ethnic minority, their army. About like 40,000 well-armed ethnic rebel groups are all over the border. So the first thing the government need to do is, whoever, either Aung San Suu Kyi or the current government or whoever they are, they have to outreach their authority to the whole map of the country. This is what we need as a state building, institution building. So that's why I'm more concerned with which institution we want to focus on in the process. People talk a lot about like presidency, executive power, because it's visible. But to me, I think it's more important to focus on parliament. We need to build a parliament. We need to make parliament stronger so that the parliament will be the only institution that can be parallel with the military. Otherwise, in the country, military will be the only by default institution that can come back anytime in the near future. So to me, I think I want to see the whole process as like more institution building, more state building process, so that we can move from institution building to institutional autonomy in post-2015. So that's why I said 2015 is a very important critical juncture. We are now doing is building all these institutions because we don't have, from banking, infrastructure, law, investment law, you name it, we don't have any institution. We have to build all these things right now. And then after 2015, we'll start talking about democratization because we already tested military, whether they are okay with, the result of the 2015 election. So that's what my brief comment on that the current process.
Would you like to comment on that, on the sure. ethnic issue?
So I think all the trouble in Burma started in this civil war, right? So if you look at all the areas that are going on, a lot of conflicts are the legacy of the colonialism. So British has basically left us all the ethnics in Burma in a state of mess. So that eventually we have a very short democratic era, about a little bit over 10 years, then becoming this civil war. So that is the root cause of all the military being the most strongest and most powerful, because when there's a war, you need the military, right? So we need to resolve the civil war. We need to, until then, the Burma will not have a peaceful democratic society. So according to the question, is Aung San Suu Kyi and this current government have a better chance? I think we don't have any other alternatives. Even what I'm seeing in Burma, what I'm seeing, the progress, what I'm seeing, all the people are speaking about, this and that, and also all the activists are saying about, all the farmers are protesting. Those are, even to me, very close to dream, because we have never seen those things in our entire lives. So Aung San Suu Kyi, President Thein Sein, and some of the reformists, as I just mentioned, the president has let go about many hardliners as well. So he is clearly calling the shots. He is clearly, his agenda has been supported by many others, even within his, former regime's cycles. So I think they have a best chance. And also people are the environment, the climates of openness and, the enthusiasm for the change, for the freedom is so great in Burma. I think this is the best opportunity and best chance we have, to do any democratic reform and change. But there's a couple of challenges I can see. Even though this regime, I don't know how far-reaching this reform will progress, how far will it go, we don't know. It is possible that we reformers go so far as the international community sees, oh, Burma is okay. There's a civilian government. There's a this and that. We are no longer concerned. But in the ground, in the reality, there will be no democracy or no real democracy. That is one likely outcome of this, what's going on in Burma. We have to be very careful about that. And also we need to be able to change the constitutions. But there's a clause in constitution, the military is invited and allowed and pre-bottom if they seize the power if country go into the crisis. So that is nowhere democratic constitution. This civil war, and also most importantly, the corruption and rule of law, that has to be established. Otherwise, I think there will be no chance. It will be just short term, just on the surface democratic change.
Stan, any?
I would only add a point that, with the with respect to funding for international donors, there's been a rush, to divert or direct more of the funding into central Burma. I think a lot of large institutional donors have a view that they either want to shore up their relationship with the Burmese government, or they think that they can influence the outcome or the direction of these reforms. And, the net result is, at least in, the immediate effect is that some of those funding has been diverted away from, the border areas and the ethnic areas. And that's something that, we all need to sort of continue to monitor. So.
Questions about economic development model taking shape in the country. Burma is rich in natural resources, and the foreign investment law is currently being crafted and debated. How concerned are you that in the rush to develop and exploit Burma's natural resources, that the country will suffer severe environmental difficulties, and that the benefits of exploiting the natural resources will not be widely shared among the population? What could be done to craft a set of institutions and policies so that the resources of the country can be developed in a way that is beneficial to all of the people?
I would hope like Burmese government would change the policy of the economic model. Until last year, Burmese government focused on the resource. Successive government focused on resource extraction. It's the key sector industry for the boosting economy, because we receive huge amount of foreign investment, and like we have a very high the trade volumes, higher than some of the Southeast Asian neighbors. So we will receive like foreign direct investment at FDI too, billions of dollars. But the issue is all of these going into the natural resources, only 1% will go to agriculture. I think agriculture is the most important, crucial, industry in Burma, but it only receives 1%. So the issue is, well, the reason why the military gear all resources, all investment to that resource sector is because this is more capital intensive, right? So it will not create any labor activities. When you focus on the labor intensive, industry, you will create like forces, labor forces. That could be like in the long run or in the medium term, because it will pose a threat to the regime stability. So for previous regime, it was perfectly reasonable. They focus on that, the resource extraction. They got the FDI, and they got all these trade, and they make money. They put the all this money into their own pocket. So, but right now, what they have to do is, if they want to attract, foreign investment in that labor intensive sectors, they need to, fundamentally change some of the laws. That's what I'm saying, like institution. Unless you have like proper institution, no investment will come in Burma. And also we need, special treatment from the Western country, like United States. Unless we have, kind of better export quota or, that kind of privileges, who's going to come and like invest in Burma where we don't have any electricities? We don't have any, a lot of transaction costs because of bureaucracy. So I think if you have like Western country guarantee you, we will buy your product, and then that we will become a like competitive, the country when we compare with Vietnam or China or other Cambodia these days. So if you want to attract they want to attract that textile industry or, you know, other that kind of investment, they need to change that these laws and these institutions. Otherwise, it will be a big trouble. And also in terms of benefit, I think, as I repeatedly say, the playing fee is very skewed, very uneven. Mm. So those who own capital and skill and institutions are still like relative or cronies of the regime. I mean, the ordinary people, they're still poor. So, and basically, if you don't craft that economic policy properly, you will empower, I call it 3C, like war criminal or cronies or crook, because they are the one who already on the upper hand. So they will reap the benefit. And then the majority of people will be like losing their land, I mean, even losing their livelihood. So I think we have to make sure that proper mechanism to proceed economic, you know, like the reform in Burma.
So actually, Myanmar Oil and Gas Corporation, so which has been you know, many investments going into Burma, you know, recommended not to work with this oil and gas corporation because of their transparency and accountabilities. So these corporations has been the lifeline of the Burmese military regime in the past. And our California company went in and built this Yarana gas pipeline, which channeled a lot of gas from Gulf of Burma into the Thailand and basically fuel the military might and keep our operations for so many years. Now U.S. is allowed to go in their businesses, right? So we are so concerned with the working with such and such corporation. Even Dong San Suu Kyi is saying she is concerned. These U.S. investment, oil and gas investment, are working with Burma, these corporations. So after nearly five decades of oppressions and mismanagements and corruptions, what has happened in Burma is middle class has totally disappeared. Many of them are so rich. Even my, you know, someone from this my village, he is a one year senior. His revenue is about a couple of millions. He is nowhere near in the regime elites, but his revenue a year, he employed about 100 people. His revenue is a couple of million a year. You know, he play golf and all, and things like that. But so many of, if we go back there, you know, we are probably hardly the middle class. So anyway, so but many of the populations, more than 50 million, are so poor. No access to proper education, healthcare, you know, food and shelters. So many of them are in big trouble. So the real danger is Burma is, you know, still so rich of natural resources, but not as many as it used to be, because all the neighboring Thailand, China, India, they cut their natural resources, all gone. In 1994, Thailand says no more logging because of huge flood. Mm-hmm. China, the same thing recently, and also India. So our forests, timber forests, teak forests, you know, all those natural resources for them to go in and take advantage of. They have already done, you know. China is building these pipelines and these roads and, you know, gas pipeline. And much of the Burmese forest close to the Thailand border is gone. And also in northern Burma, the forest is disappearing. So when the forest is gone, the wildlife is gone, the livelihood is gone. People, crucial resources that could have translated in elevating their livelihood, their way of life, will be disappeared without helping them elevate, without having their real life elevated. So that is a real danger. We have to be very careful, especially the U.S. corporations. So that's that's our concern. So we have to promote the responsible investment, responsible investment and responsible tourism as well. Tourism is also the, you know, double-edged sword. If you look at the Galapagos Island, where, you know, this where we learn about how the humans evolve, right? Charles Darwin. If you look at now, which is nowhere near the when Charles Darwin visited those islands, because what spoiled that? Tourism. So we have a real danger of tourism is going to spoil our natural resources and our pristine environment. And all those investment where all the roads are built, trees are cut down, people are being, you know, people are being, you know, employed. So those things are things that we have to be careful, especially all of us here, not just activists. Even yourself, if you go to Burma, if you try to buy the shares, you make sure that, you know, you don't encourage or you don't help these things going on in Burma.
I would only add that my sense is that, you know, the large American companies are already in the country. I mean, the large oil and gas concerns are actively negotiating in the country, and that's not even counting the, you know, your European counterparts and all the ASEAN type countries and whatnot companies. I think the key to sort of slowing that down and having effective watchdog goes back to some of the points that we discussed earlier about having a free press, having a true media that is, you know, doing investigative type journalism and actually investigating these things and publishing it and sharing that with the larger world. I think that's the one of the mechanisms that we need to try to encourage to take place in the country.
Yeah. Well, certainly the number of foreign investors in the country is staggering. Every flight in is full of prospective investors, and hotels are full and so on. And you do see quite a distinction between very wealthy, a thin slice of very wealthy people at the top, and a lot of places where they're extremely poverty-stricken and not much of a middle class, not much of a thriving, independent private sector as opposed to a crony private sector, particularly on small and medium enterprise. Let's talk a little bit about the role of other countries, outside countries, toward Burma and the changes going on in Burma, starting with the United States. Would you say that current U.S. policy is on the right track now? There's some concern that in the past year some asylum seekers from Burma have been denied asylum in the United States on the grounds that conditions have improved inside Burma. But generally, are you of the view that the current U.S. policy with sanctions being suspended but not yet fully eliminated is about right in terms of the U.S. role?
I think international community could play a significant role in the furthering the reform in Burma, because even the President Thein Sein himself admitted, you know, I mean, we really need sanctions being removed and international community assistance to go forward reform. With regard to the United States, I think the pace that U.S. is now taking is pretty good. I think even some of my colleagues who would say the whole reform process in Burma seemed to be kind of arranged marriage, you know, by the U.S. I mean, U.S. provided a huge incentive, you know. I mean, if you make some changes, we will offer this and that. So I think so far it's pretty good. But I will definitely recommend to pay attention to the military sector reform. I think we really need to make Burmese military socialize with that, you know, how soldiers behave in democratic society. If U.S. doesn't want to engage directly, at least U.S. should arrange to make Burmese soldiers to socialize with the, you know, like Singaporean or like you know, Taiwanese or, you know, South Korean, you know, that whoever had that democratic experience. So I would probably encourage we need to pay attention to the security sector reform, how we should pursue that. Otherwise, it would be more like expansion of elite coalition rather than, you know, genuine reform.
So we support the easing of the sanction, not lifting the altogether, because you know, as an activist, as a citizen of Burma, we never really like sanctions because it is in a way hurts the people. Yeah. But on the other hand, the international community hints at ties when China is supporting all the neighbors or working with the regime. So sanctions are the only effective means in pressuring the regime. That's why we support the sanction all along. So, but now, you know, some of the sanction has been released, so we welcome. But the Senate, the Congress, has been, decided to continue some of the sanctions. So sanctions, investment sanctions, import sanctions, right? Investments are now partially allowed. The import is still being, are not allowed. So anyway, I think the U.S., the policy is... In a way, I think it helps change Burma because this regime really, really needs turn away from the They need to reduce their dependency on China, so they turn to U.S. At the same time, I think U.S. is not U.S. is there not just to help Burma. Burma has become a strategic importance for them. So if you read the article that the Secretary Clinton wrote in the Foreign Policy. The future of politics is not Iraq or Afghanistan. It is the Asia-Pacific. So China has become an economic superpower. Even in military might, it's close to U.S. So United States is so concerned, try to counter China's eclipse being the whole region. So, and Burma has also become the chair of the ASEAN. So that push, China is also using Burma as a backdoor to the Indian Ocean because they needed Indian Ocean to develop their internal inland, such as Yunnan province. They need the Indian Ocean. They don't want their oils go through the Malacca Straits. It's very dangerous. They will just park their oil tanker at the oil from the Middle East and Africa at the Arakan State port, and they will just pump into the pipelines. There's going to be two pipelines, oil pipeline and gas pipeline, into the Yunnan capital, right? So. To counter this China growing influence, so United States is going there as well. So I think U.S. will continue to work with regime as much possible as they possibly could, but we have to keep our eye on U.S. not letting go of sanctions so quickly and so easily, because that is the only means and way that they will understand. They will, they will get hurt.
I would only quickly add that from a sort of a development perspective, the suspension of the sanctions from the U.S. has, removed a significant risk for many U.S.-based organizations and have allowed them to explore the possibility of working in the country. And so from that perspective, I'm encouraged by that because that brings potentially increased resources to the country. And, the U.S. government itself has provided carrots for some of these reforms. And so, again, from the perspective of trying to get more assistance to the country, I'm encouraged by that. So.
Right. And, of course, it's not just the U.S. that is these sanctions, but also the EU and right. Australia. And so you're seeing a huge increase in international aid commitments to the country. I was reminded by someone in the audience that we didn't quite address the question about the remaining political prisoners and what is likely to happen. So if you'd care to respond on that, I think people would be interested in that.
I think it's a very important the measure, that we could look at the reform process. I mean, if you have one person in prison for what his or her political conviction is unacceptable. So I think that's what the international community keep having their eyes on this issue. But at the same time, it's incredible that government decided to release like hundreds and hundreds of political prisoners, and most of them, almost all well-known figures are now released. So I think I will give a kudo, for that. But at the same time, we all have to fight for that remaining political prisoners. We should not forget their fate. And, that's what the Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and all these human rights groups are like working pretty hard to highlight on this issue, because there are so many other issues going on in Burma. People easily tend to, forget this issue. So I think it's a very important issue, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, Aung San Suu Kyi actually addressed about that when she spoke to the Nobel acceptance, right, recently in Europe. So there's more than 300s, maybe more, based on, you know, some of the figures. But we think, you know, as correctly Dawn San Suu Kyi has said, and also Secretary Clinton has said, one political prisoner is very too many, right? So as long as there's a political prisoner in Burma, the reform is reform is not quite reform. Mm. And also this reform, as like Goh Min Sen has said, it is a managed reform. Even though Dawn San Suu Kyi is doing the whole world, Europe, like ADA generation leader like Min Kho Nai, they didn't get their passport. They keep applying and it has been rejected again and again. They are supposed to be accepting the award by the NED in around September, mid-September. But they still haven't gotten their passport yet. So inequality is, you know, still there. And also the oppressions and a lot of human rights violations are happening, especially just the report today. One in three people in current states has suffered human rights abused. It is seven times most likely to be, you know, forced labor if you live closer to wherever the regime is building anything. So also remember, Burma is a only country in the history of the ILO in which ILO invoked the Article 5. That is, ILO has never invoked that article. Basically says all the members country not to deal with Burma, not to talk to Burma, not to associate with Burma. So now things are better, but there's hundreds of political prisoners in the prison. So until then, we can't stop. That's why recently during at the San Francisco Marathon, we ran, you know, free political prisoners in Burma with a banner. So we run, all the activists run. So wherever you go, you know, that is an issue that we have to keep raising. At the same time, you know, this is a reform. This is a managed reform. This is an unfamiliar territory. Nobody knows how far it will go. We must not stop. If we stop, we are very satisfying, you know. Burma will end up being a democracy that is not quite democracy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's a very good summary statement at the end. Stan, do you want to make a quick final remark?
You know, I'm just been, like many of you, have been encouraged by, you know, the extent and the pace of the reforms. And I think, you know, it's unprecedented in Burma's history, but we remain hopeful and we try to do as much as we can for the people of Burma. So,
okay, thank you. Min Sen, final thought?
Well, I just want to have that, you know, that guarded optimism. You know, I think it's a good, you know, we have a long way to go, because I see this as a more like authoritarian corporatism. You know, it's have to move on to go that democratization process. So, but as a citizen of Burma and former activist, I'm so happy to. I mean, I will have a chance to go back to Burma soon. You know, my family, I can go back and see my family after like more than 20 years of like being not able to see them. So, I think it's all emotional, personal, but at the same time, I think I thank you all, because I mean it's a. We need solidarity, right? We need, you know, not just sympathy. We need solidarity. With that solidarity in mind, we can keep going on. So thank you so much.
Thank you. So we have to draw this to a close, but on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'd ask you to join me in thanking Min Sen, Yu Than, and Stan Zee once more for their excellent presentations and discussion. Thank you.